As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's not about me. I'm only here for a minute, and I know that I can't fix it. I can help even just a little bit. Won't you let me try?
Hello, welcome to our Laz and Powers. This is Scott Powers from The Athletic. No Mark Lazarus today. We have a special episode coming to you, but Mark and I will be back at it. And I know we haven't done many podcasts this offseason, but we will be back at it full time here in the coming weeks, and we will try to be more consistent this season, as we always say. But for today, there's been a podcast I've wanted to do for a long time and just hasn't worked out with people being under NBA and NHL contracts and everything, but there's two guys I've known for a long time, Daryl Belfry, who does player development in hockey, and has worked with Nathan MacKinnon and Austin Matthews, Patrick Kane, and who I helped write a book, and he just recently released a new book, Belfry Offense. And then also Mike Procopio is the second person who's a guest on today's podcast, and he's worked with the Dallas Mavericks, and he's on the he's on the NBA side and the basketball side, and he's worked with the Dallas Mavericks and the Boston Celtics. He worked with Kobe Bryant for I think it's four seasons. Worked with a lot of top guys here in Chicago with Tim Grover. He was working with when they had an attack. People are familiar with Chicago hoops. There used to be a gym on the West Side Attack, and they trained Dwayne Wade and Juwan Howard and all those guys. And Tim Grover's obviously associated with Michael Jordan, and so there's a lot of different ties. But it's a podcast I've always wanted to do, where I thought some kind of crossover would be interesting between the two people, talking about development at various levels and working with the best players, and then getting to work with players who are just trying to stick in the league, and even youth players and development, of players coming out of college and junior and that type of thing. So it's something I've always wanted to do, and I finally was able to get them together and figured sort of this window before the NHL season got going, we got into Blackhawks hockey. And honestly, I wasn't sure how the conversation would go. It was, but it went a lot better than expected. And there's times where they just don't even have me talking to them, so it just kind of became a conversation between them, and it was really cool to have. So Daryl Belfry and Mike Procopio, and you can find both these guys have websites that they're actually pretty accessible for fans now too, and not fans, just coaches and players. And they do webinars and in Belfry's book, but if you go to belfryhockey.com and then hoopconsultants.com for Mike Procopio. So it's a bit longer than usual, but the conversation was great, and I hope you enjoy. Mike Procopio, Daryl Belfry, welcome. Thanks for coming on Laz and Powers. Appreciate you. How you guys doing?
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic, Scotty. Fantastic.
I've known you both guys forever. Mike, back to my high school basketball days and following around teams around Chicago and Daryl since I've covered the Blackhawks, and it's been about a decade there, and two guys I've always respected, and you guys have had such interesting careers, both working professionally, working for professional teams, working at different levels, working with some of the game's most elite players in basketball and hockey. And just I've always wanted to kind of bring you guys together and see what this conversation goes. But I guess starting off with Mike, you've worked with so many great players, but working with Kobe and Daryl just came out with a book, Belfry Offense, where kind of really goes really deep in offense and hockey and training players and talked about Kobe's training methods, and he has a quote from Kobe in the book. And I don't know, can you talk a little bit about how you kind of created that relationship with Kobe, and then just, having worked with him, what that was like?
Yeah, sure. So back in about 2009, I was working for a gentleman named Tim Grover, who was Michael Jordan's trainer. And I was visiting the Minnesota Timberwolves at the time with Kevin McHale, and just watching practices, games, and just sort of talking to him. And there was an article written about in the New York Times about the Houston Rockets, how they use analytics to scout against Kobe. So Tim Grover said, "Hey, Mike, have you heard of this article? Kobe read it once year." He was traveling with Kobe at the time. He's like, "Hey, he wants your input about, just to see what these people know on him and anything that you can do to sort of combat that." So I talked to him for, well, we email, we exchanged emails. He was telling me, he asked me to do a job. He just asked me to say, "Hey, look, can you investigate this? Talk to coaches, talk to people, see what they know on me. I'm not comfortable with people having intel on me like that that I don't know about." So I was like, "Okay, cool." I, talked to a bunch of coaches that I knew, advanced scouts that I knew. They always gave me the generic answer, "Hey, force them into tough shots, blah, blah, blah." And I knew, dealing with as many players that I dealt with, I know if I came back with just, "Oh, they just wanted to, force you into tough contested shots," that he'd be like, "Oh, thanks, but no thanks, and I'll never hear from him again." So I went back. I watched about six games of the Houston Rockets against Kobe, how they guarded him, the things that he was doing, and not only how they were guarding him, but some of the things that he could be doing better as far as utilizing his teammates. As everyone knows, Kobe was in love with taking tough shots and hitting the home run on every play. So I sort of analyzed that. I gave him the game plan of Houston, how they guarded him, but I also gave him about 3 pages on things that he could be doing better as far as shot selection, early shot clock, making quicker decisions and better decisions early, saving a lot of those, heroics for the, later part of the clock, like under eight in the shot clock, and then also how he could utilize teammates in different spots. So I gave it to him. I didn't think I'd hear from him again and said thank you. They played the Houston Rockets. He had like 36, including like, the last 6 or 8 points of the game. And then I heard from about, I don't know, 30 seconds, 40 seconds after getting interviewed. He was like, "Hey, we play the San Antonio Spurs tomorrow. I want the same thing." So I think the relationship part started, it was a little different where I wasn't asking him for anything. I told him, say, "Look, if we're going to work together, we're not going to be friends. I'm not going to ask you to, not getting tickets or shoes or want to talk to you about what your favorite, favorite movie is. I want to do my job. I want to be able to be as unbiased as possible." And I think that, generating a relationship isn't going to work like that. I think we have to have just a working relationship. This is how we work. And I think as we were talking after that, he was like, "Hey, look, the reason why I use you like this and I like you working with me, it's A, I always know you're gonna tell me the truth. We're not always gonna agree on things, but I know a lot of people that I deal with in my circle or, in my coaching staff, they're just either gonna agree with me or they're gonna be afraid to say anything that disagrees with how I'm doing." And I just think that honesty is what he wanted. And I think that, that's sort of how we sort of bonded and how we worked together for 4 years and, enjoyed that ride.
Does any of that ring true for you, Daryl, too, with hockey players, maybe just having, I guess, earlier in your career, just kind of proving yourself or them kind of, realizing that this is worth doing for them?
Yeah, it's like pretty much an exact replica of how it worked for me. except like my original start to get into the league was through players that I'd worked with for a long time. They were with me from the time they were 8, 9 years old and followed them all the way through. And then they made the league. So that was very different. And, you know, what struck me when we were talking was the way different relationships are with players. Like for me, I've had a couple relationships that are very, like, it's a very personal and professional relationship. And it gets, you know, there's a lot of times where there's disagreements and stuff like that. I'm not scared to tell them the truth, but it's definitely like shifts over to being a lot more personal. I care about, you know, the person and what their family's doing and all that sort of stuff. But then I found once I got in the league and I got more established and players started to seek me out. So an existing, like very similar to this, existing superstar player who's now looking for, is motivated to find new ideas. That's exactly how it is. It's, hey, it's like a project that you do to start. Hey, give me some ideas. Like I'm looking for something for whatever reason. And then you know, you do up a report, you send it off, and then you hope that they reach back out. When they do, the reason that they reach back out is because you're saying things, either one of two things. One of, like, the thing that you're talking about, which is it's an honesty thing. Like I can tell you directly what it is that's going on, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm just going to give it to you straight. There's that. And then the other factor that has been a big part of my career has been, I'm bored. I hear the same things over and over and over again. Coaching tends to be very similar. They tend to talk about things, and often the superstar player can be left to their own devices. And so they need and want different ideas and ways to become more effective in their own skill set. And they're looking for you to tell them something that they don't already know about themselves. They pride themselves on studying themselves and knowing everything about themselves. And if you can tell them something that's a little bit different, then all of a sudden you get their ear and off you go. So I found a really direct parallel to what you're talking about. And I don't think that that's going to be much different as it relates to once you get to a certain level of player. I think that's what they want. They're tired. They're either bored with the same ideas and they want something new, or they just don't trust that they're always being told the truth. And they just love to have someone who can come with them with, in my case, it's evidence-based evidence. It's not really my opinion. I've researched it. I can tell you this is what's going on. The video really doesn't lie. Here are the numbers. This is how I interpret what I'm seeing. It's really what it comes down to.
Mike, you've worked, you guys have both worked with such elite players. Are there qualities that, I guess, Kobe or that type of player that you found, you know, as you've worked with other types of players, that they just, obviously there's an athletic and a skill standpoint, but is there something about them that makes them elite? And, you know, just even having worked with them, or how they dissect the game or think the game or train, or just, you know, when you saw Kobe so closely, or those other type players, I know Dwayne Wade and a lot of those guys you worked with in Chicago, that are there qualities that you feel like that made them beyond just their athletic ability?
I think there are some. I think that it's hard to say the blanket statement of like all great players do A, B, or C. Like you hear that a lot, like coaches like to say it. Well, all great players are coachable, or all not, it's not that way. Like not every great player is a hardworking guy that's like Kobe's was different. Like I was with Dirk for 6 years. I was with Kobe for 4. And as I would want either one of them, you know, taking last second shots, or, you know, they're so dominant in their own ways, but they were different. Like Kobe was going to go blackout workouts, go hard, you know, loved watching film, doing all that, where Dirk was like, you know, he's going to put his work in. I think the similarity between like a Kobe and a Dirk was their preparation. They didn't really sort of go away from it. They they sort of had their routine. They stuck with the routine. You know, Dirk had the same shooting routine for 20 years. You know, Kobe always wanted to, you know, crush film. It doesn't matter, you know, if it was somebody he saw the first time, like a Jeremy Lin before that when San Anything started, or somebody that he faced for 15 years. It didn't matter. He wanted, you know, his, you know, game prep. Like, you know, Kobe was probably went a lot harder than Dirk did as far as like, you know, he was a psychopath with his, like, the level of work that he did and how hard he trained on the court, where Dirk just wanted to get to a spot. He put a lot of work in, a lot of preparation in, but it was a little bit different. I think those guys, you know, could slow the game down, you know, where they, like, they knew, both guys knew that they, like, when the game was on the line, a possession was on the line, they had to get to a kill spot where, you know, they didn't really lose their mind on things. They didn't really, you know, they just sort of knew, they fixated on where they needed to go and how they were going to get there. And they could slow the game down like anyone's business, but they were different in their approaches. And I think that, like, a lot of great players, they could slow the game down and then get to that kill spot. They're not panicking. I think guys like Dirk and Kobe could do that at a high, high level. And, you know, where they're, you know, and they were very simplistic in their offensive games at times. And I think that that's sort of what I took from both of those guys. Like, Dirk didn't love watching film like that. He just sort of knew, like, through, you know, I got him on year 14. So it was a little bit different. Kobe, same thing. Kobe was probably, you know, when I started working with him, it was probably, I want to say he was about 31. So, like, he was sort of, you know, right in his prime, but again, it wasn't like he was 23, 24, and I was sort of working with him from day one. So it was a little bit different, but like I said, all great players do different things and their approaches are a little bit different, but they do some things similar. Like, you know, as far as, you know, when the game's on the line or the season's on the line or something's on the line, they don't really panic and they get to their spots, and that's through experience. That's through failure. That's through sort of, you know, building up throughout a career and being ultra competitive, ultra smart in their own way. And they could really, you know, shine when they needed to.
You guys have both been doing this for so long and videos kind of evolved. You know, I feel like, Daryl, for at least I know in hockey that you were doing it so early on, teaching players who video and trying to show them that, and even, you know, sort of what Kobe, you do with a lot of players during the NHL season. How, I guess, through teaching, whether it's in person or during a season, how is the use of video used to, you know, to show them what they're doing? I guess it's, you can do it immediately now, you can show them, but also to pull out those reps, and you can see, you know, that I know big thing, you know, you talk about sequences in hockey and for them be able to see those sequences and, you know, how's that evolved in, I guess, in you know, skills coaching and in hockey specifically?
Well, like when I first started, like, I was trying to, you know, you're trying to innovate, you're trying to create, you're trying to figure it out. And there, when I first started, there was such an impression that, you know, the best players, they just, like, they were born to do it. And there's just nothing you can do to influence their hockey sense, their ability to influence, or their ability to elevate. Like, they're just special, they're different. And you should just, like, they should just be left on their own. And they're not people that you can really understand. And I was fortunate enough to be with them when they were younger. So they weren't, I hadn't built them up, I guess, in my mind. And so I had known them to be curious and known them to want to learn more and want to, and I knew the level of preparation that was going into how they were preparing to feed the greatness that they were about to do. So for me, I just never really got there with the, these guys are great, just leave them alone. So I was always trying to find just new ways, different ways to communicate. And the reason I started using video was because when I first started, I was doing only like guys in the off season. Like, I was working with them physically in the off season to improve their skill set. But then, like, a new player would come that I'd never worked with before. And I'm like, I don't even know this guy. Like, how do I, like, I don't know what they do. Like, I got to figure this out. So then I would go on the video to do my own research. And back then there was no like templates or anything like that. You got to figure it out on your own. And I was just trying to figure out, like, what do they do? Like, where do I need to start? Like, I only have a small amount of time in this off season. Where am I going to start? So that's kind of where it started. Was I was an off season skills development coach. And then during the season, you kind of let them go. And then getting them back, I wanted to just know more and be better prepared to better utilize their off season. Then it started to evolve of like, hey, can you take a look at something in my game? And then I started to look at pieces during the year. And then it evolved to, I want to see more like on a regular basis. And so what it started to be was, let me just track your habits. What do you do really well? What feeds your success? Let's go into that. And let's really dig into what you do best. And are you doing it at the frequency level that you need to do it? And if you're a great player, can you bend the game into your strengths? So like Mike's talking about understanding where the kill shot is and understanding routes and avenues and methods and techniques and footwork and all that to get to that spot. It's very similar in hockey. We don't call it a kill spot, but you have certain habits and spaces in the rink that are repetitive. They come up over and over again, and you can bend the game into that so that it comes up more frequently. So for me, that's where it started to go. And then I was tracking it from a frequency and success rate. How often are you doing it? And how successful are you when you do it? And if so, why so? And if not, why not? And that was really where it is. And I think currently where it is now is it's very similar, only it's much more collaborative, I find, with the player. So it's the player is driving the questions as much as I am. Where when it first started, like they were like, hey, tell me something I don't know. Now it's like, hey, I have a question. This is a type of thing I'm interested in. And then I would then go and figure out what that is. The other piece of it that's really interesting now is the players want to know what's going on with other players. Hey, I was watching the highlights the other night. I saw this play by so-and-so. Like, do you think that's something that could work into my game? And I feel like it could work here, but this is how I would utilize it. So the awareness, I think, of what is going on in the rest of the league is probably heightened now more than it's ever been. And the request to understand and track what other people are doing in reference to what they're doing, I think, has become more and more of something that I've been doing.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Mike, I feel like the both of you guys started this early on where the field wasn't as crowded as it is now with skills coaches. And you feel like you see stuff on Instagram all the time and people trying to sell, you know, let's sell the next innovation. And, you know, in the NBA and I guess in basketball, how much has that changed and how much is it noise? And, you know, I guess, you know, like I feel like there's so many guys out there now that it just trying to reinvent the wheel with some things, or, you know, I know in the hockey specifically, like all these devices now that people use. And, you know, I think Mike and I think you and I have talked about it, you know, how crazy it is, how many basketballs, you know, guys are out there trying to, you know, skills coaches now. And, you know, what's that been like for, you know, from your perspective and then trying to find clients or just, you know, and trying to, you know, get down to what's important to actually teach these players?
Yeah, it used to be that there wasn't really any. There was like five or 10 nationally that you knew of. And that was probably 2007, right? 2005. Like I was starting to work with players in 93, but I started really like I was in the NBA probably 2003. And like a player development coach really wasn't there. Now, not only as NBA teams increasing their staff with more and more player development people, there are player development coaches and trainers. There's more trainers than homeless people in San Francisco. You know what I'm saying? You trip over them, they're everywhere. And it's fine. It's great. The problem is, unlike Europe, where you have to be certified to be a coach at any level, where FIBA is really, you know, really involved in that process, you don't need any training. You could just basically say, I'm a trainer, let's go. And the thing is, a lot of times, you know, to get more and more clients, it used to be a lot of players, especially in the mid levels of it, not the great players, but the players that are just trying to be good, they would emulate good players that did sort of simple things at their position. It's not sexy enough for a lot of the trainers, especially on Instagram and social media. So they only emulate the great ones. They emulate Steph Curry and James Harden and what Luka does and what Giannis does. And the problem is, like, what they do, twofold on that. A lot of their highlight plays is something that you can never teach a young kid to do, you know, especially to sort of start developing them from the grassroots level up, because it's just too hard. And if you're going to teach that on a, you know, on a level where that's all you're doing throughout the whole workout. And what happens is, if you track what a player would take, like in a high level game or even a regular game, most of their stuff, they'll probably do those fancy things 1% of the time. So you're putting 98% of the workout into something you're doing 1% of the time, and it's jading the player. So if you have a high school coach or a club team coach and say, Johnny, I just need you to sit in the corner, make a corner three, guard people, and you're good, that's too boring to them. And what happens, a lot of the trainers are like dope dealers. They'll go to the kid and be like, that coach is holding you back. You need to play more like Steph Curry, you know, instead of playing like Johnny Curry, where like the real simple player, right? They want to play, oh, you need to be doing what these guys are doing. And that's all they teach. And the problem is, they do that all summer. They do it for 2 or 3 months in a row. And now they go back to their team in the wintertime. And now that player is either going to get cut or benched, because Johnny, you're not good enough to do any of the things you're trying to do in a regular game. And we need you to do this to help yourself. The problem is, the trainer never has to play the player. So then they're not dealing with minutes or, you know, playing time and things. So the parent and the player is always going to be fixated to the trainer, where the evil person is going to be the coach. It's not playing them as much or giving them the role they want to make. So it's really hurting the game in some instances. A lot of things that I do is, like, I don't really like cliches, but the one that I guess I use for my company is dominate simple. If you watch high level games, and there's nothing more high level than either the EuroLeague Final Four or the NBA playoffs. And if you watch a regular playoff game, 90% of the possessions are catch and shoot, straight line drive, you know, pick and roll play, pick and roll read, and like cutting, moving without the ball, transition. They're real simple plays. Now, when the shot clock goes down and a great player has the ball in their hands, maybe they have to make an athletic play, but that's like 5% of the time, 8% of the time. Even the high-end isolation players do it 14% of the time. Most of their possessions are just catch and shoot. They're simple basketball reads. So I think that to really better our game in the training industry and the development industry is, what are the skill sets that this player is going to need at their position? How are they going to be used in the game? And how do you implement that on a daily basis, where you're like, look, I understand you want to do all the stuff up here that these great players are doing, but to be relevant and to really get that baseline and get that trust and understanding from your head coach, let's work on these things that are going to get you in a game, develop that trust. And then when you dominate these things, then you could start moving up the food chain as far as little things that you can do. And I just think that trainers that are trying to get all these clients, they can't sell that. Simple doesn't sell with kids, unfortunately. it does in Europe a lot more than it does here. They want to hear that they're going to be the next great player, not that, look, you could be a rotation player or a starter, you know, but let's start with that. And then we build up. It's just too boring. And it takes too much time. And I think that the trainer these days are like, look, I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to put all this stuff on Instagram. It looks great. And they're going to attract all this clients and all this money, which is a lot of money to be made. But now getting new clients, I'm not really going to change my ideas of how to develop a player. And the player that I find are the ones, you know, Daryl said it about, like, a lot of the players that seek him out, that they want new ideas in the sense that they want to be challenged. But I think that they're smart enough to know, you know, what they need to be doing to be relevant. And I think that that's sort of where I see the training game today. For the most part, there are good trainers that, you know, there's, you know, Drew Hanlon, who works with a lot of NBA all-stars, and he works a lot of simplicity. He does a little bit high level things, but he works with mostly high level players like Jason Tatum or, you know, Joel Embiid and whatnot. So I think, you know, but most of the trainers don't work with players like that. And I think they need to be simple. But the problem is most of them, they go to the other side of it.
It feels like a lot of that's in hockey too. Yeah, Daryl.
Yeah, I mean, hockey player development has turned into the easiest entry point. I mean, scouting is very difficult to do. It's a very difficult life to scout. You're on the road all the time, and that's an art form that takes years and years and years to figure out. And it's accepted that that is the case. And so scouting, that's tough. Coaching is a really difficult entry point. You got to start at the bottom for most guys. And you have to, you know, you got to get lucky in terms of getting a good situation that you can win in. It takes years. You're going to get fired 5 or 6 times. You're going to move your family across all the country. That's not an easy life. Player development, like, you can do it from home. Like, you're going to have people maybe, you know, come to you, or there's players everywhere that are near your area, and you can get started right away, and you can open a business, and, you know, it's the easiest entry point. And the worst part about player development in hockey is there's a lot of confusion as to what it actually is. And because of that, whenever there's confusion and a little bit of chaos, there's a lot of opportunity on the fringes. And that's what goes on, is like, because no one can really say what it is. And the people who do know or are doing it at really the high level are unrelatable. Like the stuff that we were talking about, and you're talking about, you know, if you're going to talk about Nathan MacKinnon or Austin Matthews or, you know, Kobe Bryant or Dirk Nowitzki, like these are the top half of 1% of the top 1% on the planet. Like, it's unrelatable. And so a lot of the things that get discussed is difficult. So that's where, you know, you would never, like, to your point, talking about, you know, trying to get a player to do the stuff that these other top players are doing, like the level of the work and the process and the number of skills that need to go into being able to do that. You just don't have the amount of time to be able to do it, nor the know-how. It just takes a long time. Player development is a long process. It's not an easy, quick process. If you want to develop someone, it takes a long time. And it involves a relationship, but it also involves the person that's the player development coach. You got to know how to teach. And for some reason, and it irks me, but it is what it is, that the teaching is easy. Like, it's just something like, listen, I played a little bit. I coached for a little while. Wasn't really for me. You know what? I'm going to open a business. I'm going to start teaching, as though like it's simple to do. Teaching is incredibly difficult, especially teaching athletic skill and movement. It's really hard, and it takes years and years and years of your own personal development to learn how to do that. So where I run into my debate on player development is that I think that it's an easy entry point. No one really knows what it is, and teaching is considered easy. And none of those three things are actually true, but that's really where we're at in terms of hockey. And, you know, it does get frustrating. Like I personally think that, you know, if you haven't been teaching people and players for 5, 7 to 10 years, like you don't really know anything about teaching. Like the nuances involved with teaching, especially teaching skill, like I'm learning every day. I've been doing this since I've been 19 years old. Like it's everything I've ever known, and learning to teach and nuances of skill and all of that stuff. It's an everyday process. And the part about Instagram, and this will be the last thing I'll say on it, is Instagram is it's a 5 to 10 or 15 second wow clip to try to draw business or attention towards what it is that you're doing. Player development is a progression of things. It's not one aspect. It's, you know, in order to execute a particular skill, you know, Mike and I could probably break this down, watch one sequence of a player going from the top of the key, catching the ball, and then going to the word, like moving towards, you know, into a 15 or 20 foot shot. The number of skills needed to get to that spot, you're in the hundreds of movement, footwork, ball position, hand position, spacing, you know, the positioning of everyone else on the court. Like there's so many things that go into that. And then to just suggest that this is like easy to do, it gets pretty infuriating. But when it's the easiest entry point, this is kind of where we're at.
It's such a one-on-one relationship with when you guys are doing this off season and, you know, and one guy seek you out, but you both have worked for, you know, NHL and NBA teams. And how complicated does that become where your job is to develop players, but it's, you know, like there's a head coach who has different thoughts, or a GM that has different thoughts, or and there's so many different people in these guys' ears, like their own off-season trainers. And I don't know if you guys can both kind of maybe talk about NBA and NHL and just how and maybe where player development is in those leagues, and whether you guys agree with it, or, you know, how can that improve? Mike, Daryl, whatever, whoever wants to jump on it first.
A sports psychologist named Don Cockstein was probably one of the smartest people I've ever known to like deal with the player psyche. Always said it like this. He said, there's so many voices in a player's head, you know, from coaches to strength coaches to head coach to agent to parents to, you know, inside people, agent. And it's sort of like you go in your car and you have like 6 preset radio stations. Well, when they get in their car, there's 150 stations. And it's really hard to really focus on one thing when, you know, for instance, if a player is struggling with their shooting, well, every player development coach is going to talk to them about their shooting. The head coach is going to talk to them about their shooting. Their teammates are going to tell them about how they should be shooting. You know, even family will tell them how to shoot. Like everyone has an opinion. The problem is there's not just one person to look to. And it used to be smaller circles. Now it's just so much because these staffs are so big. The amount of people they deal with are so big. And I think that's a big problem with, you know, the development of the player. There's just so many voices. And I think even in player development, to be honest, that we can't be experts at everything. I have the idea in basketball, at least, where there should be 3 or 4 different development coaches on a team. One guy or one coach could be specialization in, you know, shooting, and one person can have their specialty as ball handling. There could be one person on defense to sort of give them little like experts at each little thing where they spend 15 or 20 minutes with them a day or so talking about a specific thing. In development, the problem is you have to focus. You can't focus on 20 things. You got to focus on, even though there's so much that goes into it, to Daryl's point, you just can't, at least in my experience, just like, you know, a player might need two or three things to really focus on and get them back in. And the problem is there's so many people trying to, you know, poke their nose in development on a team. It could be the GM, or it could be the head coach. It could be another assistant coach. And it's like, what are we doing here? We're not really, even though we talk about being on the same page, we have nice little, you know, we have nice little decks that we say about player development, this is how it's going to look, and this is great. Everybody's on the same page. And then when we get into it and things get hard, especially on losing streaks and things like that, everyone just starts doing their own thing, and it's hard. You got to keep the line with that. And really, like, I tried to be very simplistic with the player, be very consistent with my message. If we won 5 in a row, lost 5 in a row, I always was the same. I think the only time where I would be different were if the player disrespected the process of being a pro, cussed out a coach, said something he shouldn't be, was late. I think that those are the things that you tend to get upset with. But with the player in general, you've got to be consistent with your message and how you deliver it. And, you know, I think if you simplify things, get them over the hump on some things, and then you start focusing on a couple other things here and there, you're good. But there are just so many voices, and you got to keep them, especially today with the phones and the social media, and their focus point's not as good as it used to be. You have to find other ways for them to focus and try to, like, be respectful to the people trying to give you advice, but know that, like, there are certain people that you need to key in on, and everyone else, you just got to nod, say thank you, and keep moving. Because if you keep trying to get everybody's opinion and make everybody happy, you're never really going to get anything consistent, because you're always going to be changing your approach. And I think that's a tough way to live.
Daryl, with the NHL, what was your experience like?
Yeah, my attitude towards player development on a team in the NHL, I think, has really evolved over the years. Like, when we first started, there really wasn't a lot of player development going on. It was like, to Mike's point, it was like, we're trying to reduce the number of people talking to these players, not add, was the attitude, right? And then it kind of flipped and went the other way. It was like, no, we actually need more people, like person that's not directly responsible for putting them on the ice. Like, there might be some value in having a relationship with a team with a player like that and try to kind of get them going. And initially, you know, I think that when the player development on a team in the NHL, I think, is a lot easier when the team is rebuilding, or they're not expecting to win. Like, they're in the process of trying to build prospects and assets and build those up to become core pieces that ultimately you can build the team around and then try to win. Now, in that stage, you're looking a little bit more long term. You have a lot more patience for the development process. And so now you're willing to kind of allow things to kind of progress along, and the urgency that surrounds, like, he's got to get it now, or he's got to get out of this funk right now, we just lost a couple games. Like, you don't have as much of that. There's a lot more patience and tolerance, and you can stay on Mike's point, like, staying more focused on a few things, one or two things that are going to make the biggest difference, that are maybe going to be, if you fix one thing, that could have a chain reaction in five or six other things. And then now you're really working. So it's like really knowing which one of those buttons to push. Now, the closer that the team gets to expecting to win, then you have a lot of other factors that weigh into it. There's pressure, there's time. Like, should we have the player on the ice this much? Maybe we got to limit the amount of time that they're on the ice. Like, do we really need that extra time? Maybe it might be the time that they need might be better used with rest, which is a fair point. And then also, you get into, the closer you get to winning, the more it becomes like a beaver dam thing, where you're standing there and then all of a sudden there's like a little leak and you like putting a finger in the hole, like, let's just fix that leak. And then another leak pops. And you're like, so you spend most of your time, like, just trying to like fix these like little, but you're not really like fixing anything. You're just like plugging holes. And so it drifts away from what development actually is. Development is a process that takes time. There's a little bit of a time, and the player needs to move along this process. And, you know, that's true development. And then you have certain things that you can kind of fix along the way where they kind of veer off the path. And then you can kind of give them like something, one little thing that, you know, whether changes a focus or, you know, smoothens out a movement pattern, all that kind of stuff. That's different. But I just find that on an NHL team, first off, the schedule is ridiculous. And I'm sure it's the same in the NBA. Like they play 80 games, 82 games. Plus you got preseason. To win the Stanley Cup, you got to play over 100 games. That is a lot of games to play. And so you have rest and you have recovery and you have, you know, the messaging that they're getting from the team. And then they're trying to, you know, play at a high level and perform. Then you have injuries and you have all that. Like to me, one of the best windows of player development is actually in return to play. When the player is coming back from an injury, that is a much more player development conducive environment to which you can, while they might have restrictions because, you know, they have a problem with their wrist and so they don't have the strength in their wrist, or you got to be careful with how much you're shooting. There is a lot of things from a movement perspective or routes and areas that, you know, you could start to dig into on a much more relaxed level because they're not imminently going to play. But when that train is moving down the track of the season, it can get very challenging. And I don't think we're there yet from a player development perspective. I don't think there's been teams that have figured it out. I think prospect development is also incredibly difficult on a from a player development perspective in the NHL, particularly when you have to give, you draft a kid at 18, you're going to give at least a year or two, you're going to give away to wherever they're going back to. They're going back to college, or they're going back to Europe, or they're going back to the OHL or the Western Hockey League. You drafted them, but they're not under your roof. You got to give them back. You got to give them somewhere to someone else. Then they're going to be the caretaker for a year or two. And then when you get them, then you're now a year or two down the line. Because truth is, like, if he's not there by 23, the odds of him getting there and being an impact player just are so low. There's players that obviously do it, but it's very difficult. So you draft him at 18, you have a 5-year window to get to 23. Most players, you got to give away the first 2 years. Now you only have 3 years. Maybe he's got to spend a year in the minors. Now you're down to 2 years. You're looking at maybe by the time he gets to the actual roster, he pretty much has like a year to 18 months to establish himself on that particular team. Otherwise, the age curve starts to work against him and works against you, because now his role starts to solidify. Like this is who he is, and the development of like maximizing assets becomes a lot less. So there's a lot of factors in NHL player development that make it incredibly difficult to stay along what I would consider to be actual development. I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm saying there's a lot of barriers and things involved. A lot of things that Mike talked about are exact. And when I was listening to him, it's exactly the same thing in the NHL, of course, and the groups around the players are a lot bigger. But I think just even structurally, when you talk about the season and how much they should be on the ice and where things should actually be, it can be actually really difficult and challenging. And I think a lot more thought needs to go into how to actually maximize it. And like I said, my thoughts have really changed, and I now have a much better perspective now that I'm, you know, done it. I did it for 8 years with the Leafs, and I feel like I have a better idea of what I would do now than what I did back then and as it evolved.
Mike, with I guess the way the NBA's evolved with the use of the G League and even, you know, players in Europe, and do you see improvement of how player development's worked, and, you know, guys getting guys ready for the NBA, or how, you know, like, or even being on a team, like a younger guy sitting on the bench, do you see the players being developed correctly? Yeah. Or
you try to like track the different sports and how they develop, like in baseball, you know, it takes 5 years for the most part for someone to get drafted, to get in the major leagues. You know, you got to go through the rookie ball and then, you know, single, double, triple A. Some of them are a little shorter than others, but so they get humbled a lot, you know, going through. In the NBA, the problem is these guys are treated like gods since they're 11 years old. And any player that you draft in the first round, second round, even undrafted, the LeBron James of their college team. So you get them, they're getting 20, 22 shots a game. Every play is called to them. Everything's catered to them. You know, they're probably making, in some cases, they're making more than the head coach in NIL money now. So you come to the NBA, and a lot of times you have to play off of three other players. So say you get drafted, say you average 24 points a game, and you go to, I don't know, you go to the Golden State Warriors. Well, I don't care how good you were, unless you're like Victor, you know, Wembanyama, you're probably going to be playing at best. You're going to be the fourth option. So you're going to go from, you know, 24 shots a game to maybe five shots a game. Maybe, you know, maybe you won't really get many plays called to you. In the NBA, the problem is you have about 18 months to really develop a player before you have to either move on from them or they're just going to sort of lose their way. You got two off seasons, two summer leagues, you know, two training camps to really get the player ready. And the problem is the only way you're really going to get better. Now you can do, like, we had a player development program where they had to be in, you know, 90 minutes before practice. They had to have a routine in. They had to, you know, have their breakfast, see the physio coach, see the strength coach, get shots up with the development coach, seek out coaches to watch film. They practice, they do their post-practice, and then they're gone. Sometimes they shoot at night. Sometimes, you know, we would meet with them and have other things that they have to do. But, you know, that you can only do so much with that. Like, that's a great way to set their tone about being a pro, of actually having a pro mentality. Those routines are what's going to take you through it. The problem is if you're not going to play, if you, like Daryl said, if you go to a team that, you know, that you're not really looking to win, you're developing, you have all these young players, it's great. You're probably going to find time. If you go to an established team, it's why a lot of players die on the vine in the NBA, because they go to an established team. They're already two or three down on the depth chart. Even though they're a good player, they do everything right. They might have, you know, a max level player and then a player that they really like in that second slot. And it's really going to be hard to, you know, to get time. You can go to the D League. Look, they put a lot more money into the minor leagues and the D League system, but look, you could average 35 a game in the D League and it's still not NBA. You know, the only way you're going to get really good in the NBA, you're going to develop, is doing all those things, setting up your routines, getting your shots up, being a good pro, staying healthy, you know, and having a, you know, preparation, but you need NBA minutes to fail. You need NBA minutes to get your ass kicked, and then you come back the next day and see where you're about. That's the only way most players get this thing going in the NBA. There's 510 players in the NBA. There's going to be 540 after they had one more two-way spot they added. So there's 540 NBA players. There's 105 or so they get 10 shots or more a game, which basically tells you that 80% of the league doesn't get plays called for them. So you have to try to survive in a minimal amount of, you know, of opportunity and touches. You have to be coachable. You have to be patient in some ways, even if you're a high draft pick. You know, a lot of times we see top five, top six, top 10 players, they don't get to their second contract, you know, in the NBA. Not that they don't, they're traded on their team, that they don't get to the second contract. They're out of the league because it's so finicky, you know, especially with the way players are built these days, with they're sensitive, they get their feelings hurt because they don't play. They expect it because it's already always been like that since they're 11. It's hard. In the NBA, it's really tough. You know, I love the football mentality of no non-guaranteed contracts where they cut these guys like that and the head coach has total control. In the NBA, the average salary is about $10 million a year, you know, which means most of the players are making more than the coach, you know, and the respect factor to the coach isn't what it used to be. Not that it's rampant, but a lot of times players don't understand the process in the NBA of it's not going to be given to you, you know, regardless of what you were ranked and all this stuff, where you were drafted. They have coaches have to play players that are going to help them win, and you may not be ready yet, but you know, again, we only have 18 months for the most part. And if they're off course with injury, not getting minutes, attitude, any of that skill development, it's going to set them behind. If they set them behind, there's going to be 60 more players drafted the next June. And now they get behind the eight ball even more. So yes, there's a lot more opportunity to develop in the NBA, a lot more coaches, a lot more D-League. You can go to Europe, you can do that, but you only have a certain amount of time to get this thing right. Like Daryl said, like when you're, you know, in the NBA, by year five, you are who you are. If you're going to be an all-star starter, you know, you're going to be either from year one, day one up to year five. Like, no one becomes the 12th player on a team for the most part and becomes a top two player on a team in year 11 all of a sudden. Like, you build to that. And you have a lot, you know, most players from day one, everything's going to be thrown to them. Everything's going to be given to them. The organization is going to be behind them, all their resources. But a lot of times you got to earn it. And you got to, it's sort of like that Shawshank Redemption where that guy had to go, you know, they had to crawl through that, like, you know, quarter mile pipe of crap. And that's what you got to do, but you got to crawl through it and you got to deal with failure. You got to deal with setback. You got to deal with all of that, but you got to keep your mind focused.
Can I jump on that there?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I thought you brought up a great point, which I think deserves more attention here, not only in this call, but also like just going forward with anybody who's talking about player development as relates to, you know, the NHL or the NBA. One of the big challenges, I think, and you brought it up with when you were talking about there's only like, you know, 20% of the players are actually getting plays called to them. And, you know, you were not that guy. You're all of a sudden not that guy. It comes down to what else you can do. So what else can you do? How can you create value on this team if none of the balls are getting thrown to you and you're not going to be expected to shoot? And that's really been your game since you were 11. And now all of a sudden it's like, listen, I'm not getting the ball and you're not giving me the ball. Like, what else can I do? So I'm sure there's lots of different ways, whether it's rebounding or setting picks or whatever it is. I don't know, being good defensively. I mean, there's a way.
Daryl, how is that in hockey? Like, so we have off the balls players in basketball, cut, they rebound, they screen, and they do other things. How is that? Again, I love watching highlights of hockey. I haven't been the one that would watch games, so I don't really know much about the game at all. What are those types of players in hockey that don't get a lot of shots?
Yeah, those are, I mean, there are people in the league whose job is to set the table for the next line that's coming out. So, you know, in our game, you know, the line is changing, you know, every 35, 45 seconds, a new group is coming on. And so your role could be to take to when you step on the ice, whatever the conditions of the ice are. So the other team has the puck, they're in, you know, they're on their way into your zone. And now you got to go, you just stepped on the ice and now you got to go back into your own zone and win the puck back, transport it through the neutral zone, get it in the offensive zone, try to find a way to keep possession of that puck so that now you can change. So that the next group that comes on, the conditions of the game have improved because you were out there. So your entire job is to take a bad situation in which maybe the line before you was giving up shots and the goalie made a save and now they have a defensive zone faceoff. So your job is to win the faceoff, or if you lose the faceoff, try to get the puck back. Don't give up any shots. Don't give up any chances. Don't give up any momentum. Win the puck, which means you're going to have to be physical. You're probably going to have great defensive stick detail. You're probably going to have to be positionally on the money. And then now once you get it, your entire job is to bring the puck up the ice to give it to the next group and improve the conditions of the rink. That could be your job. But I mean, but those are players who they scored, you know, 30, 40, 50 goals when they were in junior that are now coming in. They're like, listen, like if you can get a shot, because the clock is ticking, like you guys have like 24 second clock for the clock to actually tick to where the shots can be taken. Our clock is shift time. Mm-hmm. So if you're not an elite player, like you're working off of like a 30 to 35 second window of your shift. That window of your shift, like you're going to spend quite a bit of time without the puck. And now you got to try to find a way to win it. So you're always starting at a deficit and then you have to try to create an advantage, just like a minute, a small advantage for the people coming out. Well, that requires a whole different skill set than shooting the puck in the net 35 times. It's just very different. So I think that your point is such a good one in that so much of player development at the NHL level is trying to figure out what skills this player might have that would provide him the best base to be able to learn these other skills or apply these other skills in puck recovery and in winning pucks back and in being competitive and being able to set the table and make plays for other people. What other skills do you have? Because we really don't need you, or frankly, sometimes we don't even want you to take shots at certain times in that shift. And so that whole thing is a player development. It's not really like learning to shoot for some players. It's not to shoot better. It's to have a, to be in better position. Because if you're 1 foot out of position in the NHL, you're really 2 feet out of position or 3 feet, because you're 1 foot out of position. It's going to take you a foot to get back to the position that you were supposed to be in. But now you lost that time. You're now a 2 steps behind. So being in the right spot, being able to understand the game in terms of how it moves offensively so that you can defend it is incredibly difficult, but that's what you're doing. So the, one of the reasons why you want to have a guy who scored 30 goals in the OHL come in and be on your checking line and kill penalties is because he should have a reasonable understanding of passing lanes and how offenses tend to move and being able to read people offensively. Not so he can be good offensively, so he could learn to defend and be defensive. But it's a really hard to be a defensive guy growing up and then all of a sudden know how to be on offense. So it's incredibly difficult. And then the window, like the window is so small to be able to learn and figure out these skills. And often it's those who have the depth of skill that they come in with. Those are the people that have the most ability to adapt and adjust. And I think the role in player development outside the NHL and outside a pro, and when you're talking about, I want to be a skill development coach and I'm going to start with kids and grow up all the way through. If you can be someone who allows these players to acquire a depth of skill that could be leverageable to be able to give them an opportunity to do a variety of different things, that might be your best approach to learn the game and learn how to develop people. But I thought that was one of the, what was a great point of how difficult it is to be the one or two or three slot where balls are getting moved towards you. And if you're not, what are you doing? Like, are you Dennis, the old Dennis Rodman, taking zero shots and rebounding 35 balls? Is that really what you're doing? Maybe that is what you're doing, or you're diving on the floor, or you're, you know, setting one pick after another or trying to draw charges or whatever it is that you do in basketball. We need to do the same thing in hockey. And there's a lot of players that they get stuck in this like middle ground. Like, you're not good enough to be a top six forward who's relied upon to play offense, but you don't have the depth of skill. You don't have the depth of skill to do the other things that we need you to do. So you're probably better than some of these other guys if we looked at it just skill for skill, but you don't have the depth of skill to be able to go get pucks back, so you can't play in the league.
Yeah. That's, you know, it's funny. It just, I think everybody, I don't know how it is in skill development in hockey, especially the ones that aren't in the league that are just sort of on their own working with players. Everybody wants to work with the great player. You know, they want to work with all NBA players. I like to work with the guys that are, you know, I like to work with guys that are sort of just bottom feeders. I want to work with the player that needs the work, that they're never going to be a great player, but they have a good chance to be at that mid-level player. But they need, you know, it's hard, and you have to have, like, you know, like when I was talking about my relationship with Kobe, that was different. A lot of times that when I work with players, I was very close in the sense that not go out with them and stuff like that. I always think there needs to be a line, you know, between you and the player. And in that sense, you want to be there for them. You talk to them, you text them, they know you're there for them and you have their back. But like with Kobe, it was like, look, I just want to be, because there's we were getting into a time where all these trainers were hanging out with players, taking pictures of them, going out to eat with them, going to the club with them. I definitely wanted him to know that we were different with that. But I think that when you're developing most of these players that aren't go-to guys, and like you said, they're confused of what type of player they need to be. I think that, you know, I was very good at communicating to those mid-level players where all day, every day, I was like, look, dude, you're not this guy, but you could make $100 million in your career being this guy, being right. the seventh guy, being the eighth guy, being the fifth guy. You know, it didn't matter. But like, look, you need to have that routine. You needed to be coachable. You needed to have preparation. You needed to have that one skill that can get you in a game. Could be shooting. It could be rebounding. It could be defense, whatever that one thing is. But let's keep focus, where then you would have other coaches trying to tell players they were great every day. You can't tell players they're great every day, especially when they're not great, because now they're going to be jaded as far as what they expect on a daily basis. We're like, dude, you know, it ain't going to be pretty for you. But all these average players are making over $100 million these days in their careers. And if you stay on course and you have a skill, but you understand that it ain't, you're not going to be that guy. Maybe when, you know, at the end of the year, when teams are load managing more, there's going to be 5 or 6 or 10 games in the second half of the season where you're going to get a lot of opportunity. There's going to be that time where we're playing back to back. We're in Golden State down 19 after the first time out. And then the coach just clears the bench and like, you know what? We need the rest. What's good? Yeah, you're going to get your time. But mostly in this league, this is who you're going to be. Let's stop like lying to ourselves. This is what you are. And it's cool because you can make a hell of a lot of money. You could be a good player. And for the most part, you're probably going to play for 3 or 4 teams. Everybody does. And you're going to get to a team where you're going to have a higher sort of plateau of where you're going to be. And then, yeah, you're going to have a fun time with it. But if you stay focused on being a pro, you stay focused on that routine every day, you stay focused and just always being ready, you're going to be fine. But a lot of these players, they walk around, they're confused. All these coaches are afraid to talk to them and be honest with them. And that's where they lose it. And that's why a lot of these players don't get to that fifth year or sixth year or seventh year, because nobody really puts them on a path. Their agent's telling them how great they are. Everyone's telling them how great they are. They're watching the Instagram. They're watching all the stuff. And no one says, okay, this is great, but like, what's your plan every day? And I think the off the court player development is just as important of what you do on the court with these guys, because they need that mentality. They need that like routine every day, and they need someone telling them where they're really, because the feedback is bad. Like, I don't know about hockey, but in the NBA, like if you up to a coach that says, you know, you go to a coach's office, say, hey coach, you know, what can I do to play more? And then of course the coach is going to be like, he'll open up the book of cliches and like, okay, let me use this one today. Oh, just stay with the process. You'll be fine. Or, you know, just keep playing hard. Or no, like they don't give them specific feedback. And I think if you're going to be a really good player development coach, that feedback almost daily with your players is really important about how they were doing, where they lie, what they can be doing to, you know, to get better, and just sort of being honest.
I think that's such a critical point that you made there. The way in which you offer feedback. I think in hockey, one of the real challenges is the hardest guys to work with are the guys that are like they're in the two or three guys that are next to be called up to the league,
mm-hmm.
and the two or three guys who are in the window that like they could be out. So they're in the league. They're just trying to hold on. You got those guys. And then you got the guys who are out of the league that are next to come in. Those are that window of player is very difficult. They're the hardest. Like you would think that those would be the easiest guy to work with. They're actually the hardest guys to work with, because the willingness to try something different or change or be quote unquote coachable is not as much. The guy's like, look, I'm almost there. Like I'm right there. And now you're going to ask me to change something or adjust my thinking or adjust my, like, leave me. Like, I can't be doing that. Like I'm right there, or right. I'm holding on. I'm right there. I'm in the league. I'm holding on.
Right.
Like, I can't, don't tell me nothing. I don't want to, I just want to, I'm right there. Meanwhile, those players are the guys that need a lot of that stuff the most. One of the challenges in our league is very similar to what you talked about with the D League, where a guy's scoring 35 and it's not good enough to play in the NBA because he's not going to score. He's not going to do the things he's doing. The game he's playing in the D League is not going to be the game he plays when he moves up, is what I'm hearing. The same with our guy. The game he's playing in the American League, he's on the top line. He's probably on the power play. He's generating points. He's effective. He's important. He's on the ice a lot. He's playing 20, 22 minutes. Mm-hmm. Now he gets called up. He's in and out of the lineup. He's playing maybe somewhere between 5 to 8 to 7, 8 to 9 minutes. You go from 22 minutes where you're in a rhythm, the puck, you're touching the puck a lot. You know, you're making plays. Now you go up. You're not touching the puck at all. You could go in real time. You could go 20 or 30 minutes between shifts. And now you got to go out there and probably throw the body or win a puck back or have a good stick or be mentally really dialed in. The game is so fast.
Right.
It's really hard, really, really hard. And I think that's another big factor with player development is that window of player. The game that they're playing to get them there is not the game that they're going to play once they get there.
Yeah, I agree. Like with our minor league coaches, I always would tell our guys when we have players coming down, is like, look, I understand you're trying to win games. Because like in baseball, a lot of times, like they just care about the development part. I don't know much about hockey development, but I study it a little bit in baseball. And knowing that like they understand they're not really going to win, especially rookie league and in the single A ball. In basketball, those guys are always trying to win games because they think that that's the way to go up. And I agree. The D League and the NBA G League isn't really about development. They say it is, but those coaches want to win. And sometimes you have to do certain things that you're not going to win games if the player is going to get better. And I always thought that if we had a player, say a center, that would never touch the ball much, you know, in our like if he did play minutes for us in the pro team, going down and force feeding the ball in the post 25 times when he goes to the minor leagues isn't going to help. And I said, look, I understand that these guys are good enough to close out games for you at the G League level. So why don't we just do this? Why don't we have them? First of all I care about them is playing 30 minutes a night. I don't care about how many shots they're getting. Right. I do care about the minutes because they do need them because they're not getting them with us. The second thing is let's keep their role the same. If you're going to throw the ball to them the last few minutes of a quarter or a game and you need the possession, you need to score, great, do that. But they can't, if they're a non-ISO player and you're going to ISO to them all game and they're going to be doing that, say they're going to play 12 straight games for you and they're not going to come up to us until game 13. So 12 straight games, their mentality is, I'm going to be, you know, Klay Thompson for this team, or I'm going to be Giannis for this team. And then they go up for us and you're like Giannis's third brother with us. You're never going to touch the ball. Like, yeah. That's going to mess their mentality up. Yes, it's going to get them a little bit better of an offensive player because they're getting the reps. I get that. But that's never going to be their role. And it's all about mentality. I always like to keep guys. There's a great book that I read about Mike Tyson's trainer, Gus D'Amato, and how he trained and how mentally he kept them focused on the task at hand. And I think with players, you got to keep them every day like in a caged animal motivated, especially the great players forget about it. I never even want to touch him. I got lucked into working with Kobe Bryant. I've been put on the earth as a basketball coach to work with those middle guys. And I love that mentality because I just want to get them like just motivated to do their job and not to try to get like, go to your right, go to your left, just straight ahead. And minor league stuff, just like you said, it brought up a lot of memories of fighting that fight of, look, I get what you're trying to do, and it's good for the player a little bit. But now if we need them to play and we got a head coach who's super old school and now he's thinking he's going to be this loosey-goosey player and he gets to this guy and this guy's going to have a heart attack coaching him. And that was going to mess the player up. It's going to mess the team up. It's going to mess his development up. And that's a tough one too. And I always fought that fight in summer league. I don't know what you guys have, if you even had something like a summer league that we had, where like we draft a guy 3 weeks later, they're in the summer league playing. Like, I always had problems, especially second-year players, rookies who didn't play a lot, and now they understand that this is their only time to shine because they have a lot of guys ahead of them. So they're going to take 35 shots a night. And I'm going to be like, look, that's great, but that's fine. If you want to take a lot of shots, great, but let's take them into the offense, the shots that you're going to take for the pro team. And they hated that. But, again, it's a mentality thing that you can never break from, I think.
We've spent a lot of time talking about the NBA and NHL, and I know talking to both of you that, you know, Daryl, you wrote about in your book about women's hockey and how that's kind of evolving with development. And Mike, I know that, you know, you've talked about working a lot with a lot more high school girls players and women's players, and how in both of your sports, I guess, you know, with player development and how's that sort of evolved with the women's game as well?
Go ahead, Daryl.
The women's game is, like, to me, it's not I don't know the best way to describe it. Like, the women are way more capable than the people that they have around them most consistently. So I think that a lot of our best talent in terms of teaching and coaching and assessing, they are obviously attracted and have had many more opportunities on the men's side. And on the women's side, we have to do, and I've tried to be an advocate for it and provide as much opportunity as I can, is we have to find a way to create more opportunity for women to learn, to teach, to coach, to assess at a high, high level. And put them in situations in which they can understand what that is, so that when they are now stewards of the next generation of athletes, that they're able to provide the next level for those girls. And for the longest time, it's better now, and I think we are getting that way. We're turning the corner for sure. But for the longest time, the player was so far ahead of the people that were coaching them and training them that it just left them with, they were stuck. And so the game got stuck. I mean, still, like, not so much now, but like even in the last two Olympics, for example, there's still a ton of one-on-one hockey that's played in women's hockey at the elite level. And the reason for that is because they can still leverage that there. And so learning how to play off the puck and learning how to be able to play like a true, like, sophisticated offense, it just isn't there yet, because they don't need to. They can still leverage individual skill. They don't understand necessarily and have been exposed to ideas and concepts and a leveraging of their skill to be able to work with others, to be able to read off of them, to be able to do other things. We're still, the best players in the game are still doing things more on an individual leveraging of assets rather than the way in which they work in coordination with others, which is really the next step for that game to grow. And I think with the pro league that we're now going to have, they have six teams. The level of talent will probably be better than even any Olympics. With six teams at that level, I'm really fascinated to see what they're able to do, because then you will have a lot of kids, the depth chart, you'll have kids on a fourth line who can legit play, or it'll be national team members who have been college players who've scored, been the best players on their team and are legit superstars that are now playing like on a fourth line role, and watching the way in which they can organically start working together more to be able to understand the sophistication or the ability to play offense without having to ultimately just leverage your one-on-one ability. That's the next step, and it's coming, and you're starting to see it more and more, but the women's game just has been lagging behind because they just haven't had those people around them enough. And I think it's starting to get there, and it's starting to get really exciting. I think not only just the pro league, but just where the game is going. I think women's hockey is awesome, and I think it's on its way to becoming even greater. And I can't wait for more and more resources to get to these girls because there's so much capacity there. You got some brilliant athletes.
Mike, you've been working with a lot more women players too, right?
Yeah, I work with a couple of all-stars in the WNBA, and I love the WNBA game. I think I would rate it ahead of NBA regular season for the most part, just because playoffs are so good. The European women's game in the EuroLeague is very high level. I think that when you're coming from the men's side, you just have to sort of dummy down your expectations athletically and some of the things they can do, size of the position. But I love the way they play. They're very skilled. They move well without the ball. They pass the ball. They can shoot. They play through the post, which isn't really done on the men's side. I think unlike the hockey part, you know, women's leagues and high-level college, there's been a lot of women's coaches. There's been men's coaches in the women's game. So they've had the coaching. I think that what they're sort of dealing with is the financial side, where to make it work financially. I don't think WNBA players should be paid like NBA players, just because it's collectively bargained in the NBA and how they sort of had to develop their game, where they weren't really getting paid a lot in the 50s and 60s. And basically, you know, the way they figure out salaries in the NBA is they take all the basketball related income, you know, from the whole league generated, they split it in half, they divide it by 30, and that's the salary cap. Where I think same thing with the women's game, have to figure out how do you be financially sort of efficient, where they could survive on their own, and then they could have this revenue in the middle, because the basketball is great. The problem is, you know, the max contracts in the WNBA is like $225,000, you know, where like they can make, and then what they do is they play in the summer, and then in the winter time they play overseas. So women's players only get a couple of weeks a year, maybe a month tops off of, as far as like not playing. So they'll make a really good player in the WNBA making 225 might make 600 playing in Russia or playing in Italy or Spain. So the basketball is good. The coaching's good. They just have to find a way to make it financially sort of make sense. Like in the NBA, guys coming in the NBA, even with the NIL these days, you're probably getting the high side of $1 million, $1.5 million of players making in college now, where they go to the NBA, their contract is what it is. So, but they want to come out as early as possible to get that money. And the WNBA side, you have a Caitlin Clark who's playing for Iowa. She's probably making $1.5 million, if I had to guess, in NIL money, where she'd stay all 4 years. She'd go to school 10 years, like Tommy Boy, for God's sakes, because right, yeah, she wants to keep making $1 million. When right. She goes to WNBA, her contract's probably going to be like $75,000, you know, until she gets to that, and that max, until like the fifth year, then that kicks in at, you know, 225. That's the type of player she's going to be. And even then, she's going to be making more in Europe than she's going to be making in the WNBA. They just have to figure out how you expand the league in the sense of people liking it, people spending money into it, sponsorship dollars, ticket sales, where now they could start sort of, you know, now increasing that money. Because again, it's the same thing. NBA, all the basketball related income, I told you again, 50-50 divided by 30, you got to spend a floor level of your salary cap. That's how, you know, if you're a max level player, you're 25% of the salary cap. So you understand the salaries, how it gets there. You just can't say, well, women's rights and they got to get paid as much as the men. Well, that then financially that league will never last. You got to figure out how do you make it financially make sense. I love the women's game. Again, the two players that I work with now, Arike Igbinwale and Satu Sabli, I wouldn't trade them for the world, as far as clients that I've even worked with on the male side, as far as their, you know, they love it. They work. They're inquisitive. They're curious. They, you know, they're just great people, and it's awesome. They just got to figure out the financial side to make that a more stable, you know, venture.
Yeah, I agree. I think what, I don't know if you saw this, but it was all over social media there the other day, but there was a volleyball game that was played in Nebraska, mm-hmm, and they had 92, I think it was over 90,000, mm-hmm, people. And the social media, they came out of that, they had a whole, like, they had the entrance and, you know, coming out into the stadium and And then they went in and they obviously they played. I mean, that's somebody that's come up with an idea that's a little bit different, that allows to get a lot of eyeballs on women's volleyball. I personally didn't know anything about women's volleyball. All of a sudden now I'm looking at Nebraska. I'm on YouTube trying to find volleyball. Like, I'm in now. Like, I thought that was really cool. I think that coming up with, to your point, coming up with different ways to get more eyeballs on the sport, to highlight what's great. Cause that, like, to your point, you know, when you go to the WNBA and you're comparing it to the NBA, it's two different sports. They play two different sports. In hockey, it's very similar. Although for the longest time, the women's game was being modeled after the men's game. And it's such a difficult thing to be able to do because of obvious reasons. What I'm looking forward to, and I really hope this new women's professional league does, is they kind of shed that. I'm hoping they get rid of that as a goal. And instead of trying to be more like the men's league, just find whatever assets that they have that are really pleasing in terms of good hockey to play, exciting brand of hockey that, you know, that showcases their talent. Cause these are talented girls. Like, these girls are ridiculous. Great skill, great talent, great speed, unbelievable minds. If they can find a way to not try to be more like the men's league and be more and find those key leverageable assets and then sell that as a piece, I think that that may be more sustainable and give them maybe a different product that allows them to then highlight what that's great and then be able to sell. The other thing too is getting what I loved about the thing in Nebraska was just the number of women that were there. Like, there was so many women that were there watching this. I think that's a really incredible thing, and getting more women to support women in their sports like that and go out and watch them and be able to play and provide more opportunity for them to be able to do that, I think would be great. So I think that this new league, like, we're in a situation, Mike, where we have the women are finally getting a professional league. And that I think it's so exciting because it's taken a long time to kind of get there. To get to one league, they had two leagues for a while and they were competing and it got a little convoluted. And now they have one league. They're going to have all the best players in that league that they can. They only have six teams, so they can get them from all over the world and get them in this spot. It's just a real opportunity. And I'm really hoping that they're able to capitalize on this and create a living that allows these girls to get rewarded for the work and the effort and the talent that they actually have. And I'm really excited for it.
Cool. No, guys, I appreciate all the time you guys have given me. Both, this has gone better than I even imagined. And you know, for people who are listening, these guys are, they both offer memberships. If you go to the hoopconsultants.com, Mike has memberships to players and coaches and belfryhockey.com. Daryl does the same too. And Daryl just came out with a new book, Belfry Offense, you can find on Amazon, and I'm sure there's a link on his website. Is there anything else you guys wanted to plug? Anything that we've missed? Anything you guys want to further discuss? And I appreciate all your time.
Oh, it was awesome. I really appreciate your time, Mike. I don't always get an opportunity to get outside of my sport because you just spend so much time and, you know, working in your sport and you get into your same circles. Sure. It's just really nice to be able to talk to someone who's in player development, but in another sport, and just to see the similarities and the differences. I really found a lot of value in the call.
Yeah, same here. I just think, you know, these kids are human beings that we're working with, and, you know, they've got same issues, maybe different, a little bit different, but a lot of times it's just, you know, trying to guide them to the right way. And it's a tough thing to do, because like you said, it's a lot of the doing the same things over and over and over and over again, the same. It's a boring deal. Development is a very boring thing. And it's boring to some. I like boring, to be honest, but that's just, it's fun to see other sports. Like I said, the hockey side, I don't know a lot about, but a lot of, you know, similar things that we deal with. So no, it's been cool.
Cool. No, Mike and Joe, thank you so much.
And I know that I can fix it. I can help even just a little bit. Won't you let me?